This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla It's Friday. It is Friday, and that means it's Godzilla. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. I write for The Film Verdict. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I contribute to Slash Film. Mm. You may call me Mechagodzilla. Mm. Mechagodzilla is my favorite.
Whitney likes Mechagodzilla.
Mechagodzilla is so cool. It's like Godzilla, but a robot.
I like to think that if you and me met Mechagodzilla in person, in real life, he'd really like us.
He'd hang out with us.
Yeah.
Buy us a beer.
Yeah.
It'd be really cool. I'm not a beer guy, but I'd have a beer with Mechagodzilla.
I think I'll name my first child Mechagodzilla.
When we first met Mechagodzilla back in 1974...
Not me and Whitney in this scenario we just invented.
Film audiences first met Mechagodzilla. First of all, was at first wearing a Godzilla suit, and then that got ripped off. And it was a robot underneath. And Mechagodzilla had cool rockets and weapons and stuff, like laser beams.
Well, yes.
Everything my inner 8-year-old loves is embodied by Mechagodzilla, and there's all those cool things where he's like firing I-beams in one direction because his head swiveled his head all the way around, and then missiles out of his fingers in the other direction. You need cool weapons if you have a Mechagodzilla.
Well, yeah.
I feel like
if he had embarrassing weapons, like he shot rubber chickens at you, like
it'd be a little
that'd be weird, right? Why bother like, at that point? That's a waste of money.
So we had that, and then we had Terror of Mechagodzilla, where we got sort of like a second helping of the same thing.
Yes.
Then we had, in the Heisei era, Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla 2.
Yes.
And I feel like that film was sorely lacking in weaponry. Even though in the continuity of that film, Mechagodzilla was a human construct.
Yeah, the first two Mechagodzillas were designed by aliens to impersonate and or destroy Godzilla. And then in Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla 2... which was a 2 in name only, and even then I think it was only in America, it was designed by humans to fight Godzilla, which really makes more sense.
And then they repurposed that robot into Mogera in the following film.
Yes, good stuff.
Plenty of fun weaponry that the Japanese people put in there.
How'd you mix those up?
humans, Americans.
Yeah,
people. It is late. It's always late when we record these. So we sound... you catch us at our stupidest. By the way, there are times when we're actually sharp and we get this stuff right.
Remember when we used to record during the day?
It was nice, wasn't it?
Oh, that was
good. It was nice, but at the same time, I was working nights at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would work until 3 in the morning, and that was killing me.
You're right,
I'm glad I'm not working nights anymore.
Yeah.
Point being, we're finally back to Mechagodzilla in the Millennium Era.
Yes.
It's from the same director as Godzilla vs. Megaguirus.
Yes.
Which had some of the coolest fight stuff.
Yes, very much so. One of my favorite Godzilla fights ever.
So, now we have a director who knows what Mechagodzilla is supposed to be all about. And that's the cool weapons shit.
Yeah.
So, Mechagodzilla, again a human construct, but different this time, and we'll get to it.
We'll get to it.
But equipped with not just the Super Mazer... Which is sort of like the Death Star weapon, like the central lightning weapon.
There's been a conceit since like the Showa era that one of the weapons that humanity keeps trotting out against Godzilla and all of his monster bros is kind of like a satellite dish mounted on the back of a truck, and it would shoot some kind of weird ray, and that's essentially a mazer, which I guess is like a moderately cool laser. So we shorten that to a maser.
Well, laser is already an acronym.
Right, right.
So I don't know what the M stands for in maser, though.
Okay, I'm gonna see if there's... I'm gonna look up the acronym for laser.
Well, light amplification stimulation. Yeah. I mentioned radiation.
Okay, monster amplification, stimulation.
Sure,
radiation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, do you remember your 7th grade science classes?
No, I don't remember my 7th grade science classes. I've worked very hard to forget my 7th grade science classes. No, that's not 100% true. I've worked very hard to forget my math classes.
I'm still sharp on math, like maybe through trigonometry, and after that it gets a little hazy. I can't remember anything I learned in calculus, and I had to take a class twice.
Any math I learned through the 6th grade, solid. Any math I learned after the 6th grade, maybe two things. I remember maybe two things off the top of my head.
All right. So, like up through pre-algebra, like that's it for you.
Pre-algebra, yes. Okay. And honestly, kind of hazy on geometry as well.
Oh, geometry is easy. It's just formulas. Just memorize formulas.
Oh, just formulas. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's my problem. I always thought formulas were difficult for me. Turns out, I guess not.
Just little cute little number patterns. You plug stuff in, you calculate it out. It's simple.
I have the internet for that now.
Look, if I'm ever on Jeopardy, I can tell you.
They
like,
don't usually make you do a lot of math
how
on
to
Jeopardy.
Calculate the volume of a cone. Like, I can do that kind of stuff.
Very often on Jeopardy.
Sometimes it does.
I said very often.
Also, stuff about, the Punic War or the history of Ecuador. They got it's all in there.
No, I do okay on Jeopardy. I just wouldn't be good at the math.
Point being, Mechagodzilla is a badass. And not only does Mechagodzilla have that satellite dish Mazer implanted in his chest, also has, missiles. And in this particular film has the... Is it called the Absolute Zero Ray? It's a freeze ray.
Yeah.
That, according to dialogue in the film, like, freezes things to a molecular level.
Yeah.
Because that's what Absolute Zero does. It's so cold that it atomic motion seizes.
Yeah, it's not just, like, 0 degrees Fahrenheit or Celsius. It's literally so cold that atoms stop moving. And... I first learned about this premise from an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000 called EGA. And at the beginning of that episode, Tom was going to freeze Croty Robot to absolute zero. And when their creator, Joel Robinson...
Negative 459 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, sure. You remember number stuff. I think I was going to trust you. But Joel.
Oh, right. We just established you don't remember 7th grade.
I don't remember. I'm bad at any. Anyway, but Joel said, I remember MST3K, by God. And Joel said, if you freeze him to absolute zero, that's going to start a chain reaction that's going to kill us all.
Mm.
So I was pretty sure that if you put something at absolute zero, it would, like, destroy everything. But apparently not. No, not according to Godzilla against Mechagodzilla. I trust Godzilla against Mechagodzilla because they do a lot of science in this movie.
They do a lot of science in this movie. There's a lot of fighting in this movie. Mm-hmm. There's some pretty good character work in this movie.
Well, yeah, because it's the same character work in Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla.
Yeah, but so it works. Do it again.
This is the same director as Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, and we'll talk about it. Basically the same plot.
Basically the same plot.
Yeah, it's weird, like, how on the... refined, I would argue, but basically the same plot.
Refined, same plot, but equally spectacular monster action.
Very cool monster action,
And we said this before about how in the Showa era there was a pretty reliable structure about how first 30 minutes is all set up, there's a monster coming.
Human subplot that is surprisingly of a different genre.
Yeah, it's like really, really involved, but only for that first 30 minutes. Like, that human story usually falls away by the time the monster shows up, which is usually right at the 30-minute mark.
Like, I know you're here for Godzilla, but first we got to look at this cartoonist who's looking for work for 30 minutes.
And it's also during this time that we're introduced to, like, whatever enemy monster might be in the movie, and there's, like, a 30-minute portion where they're essentially drifting slowly together. Sometimes, literally, they're walking across the landscape.
Yeah.
Then at the 60-minute mark, they finally meet, and then the last 30 minutes is just, like, monster fight.
Well, do you remember the old bit? Was it John, Masha, John, Masha,
Godzilla, Gigan,
Godzilla, Mothra.
Nice.
Just coming closer together, and they're finally gonna hug it out or fight, and that's what that's their thing.
Shin, Mothra. So that was pretty reliable. Yeah. It worked for that era, and it started to become comforting after a while. To the point where when you saw something that deviated from it, it felt a little weird.
It did feel weird.
Yeah. Millennium Era, they've abandoned that because they want to get to the monsters right away.
Yes.
So, waste no time. This is an 88-minute film. Godzilla's in the first scene.
This might be the single most efficient Godzilla movie I've ever seen. Like, yeah. It's just, there's no fat on this. It's all stuff that's there and is cool or is important later. Okay, so once again, we're in the Millennium Era, and with one exception, and that's going to be the one we talk about next time, with one exception, they're all reboots. Every single one of these is a totally different take on Godzilla. I guess except for this one, because it's also the same take as Godzilla versus Megaguirus. But anyway, Godzilla attacked in the 1950s. It was pretty bad.
Uh-huh.
In Godzilla versus Megaguirus, they hypothesized that Godzilla was attacking because every time we tried to create some kind of new energy technology that was in some way bad for the planet, Godzilla would destroy it. That's not really the case here. What they decide is that monsters, giant monsters, have a tendency to attack in the middle of a typhoon. So basically, we're equating them to a natural disaster in this one. In the years that followed the initial Godzilla attack, and they did use the Oxygen Destroyer and kill that Godzilla in this continuity, a bunch of different monsters have attacked, and we get some recycled footage from Mothra, we get some recycled footage from Frankenstein Conquers the World, a few others as well.
It's odd that those are the ones that this film is choosing to deem canonical.
Yeah.
Like, again, this is like they were saying, these monsters have attacked, but we haven't seen Godzilla for 50 years.
Specifically Godzilla, we thought we were done with. And we have come up with some pretty effective means of destroying these monsters. We've got these maser weapons. They're pretty good at destroying these monsters. It's just something we have to deal with every once in a while. And we have an entire division of the military. It's like 4,000 people dedicated to this semi-regular threat. So while this is bad and certainly dangerous, it is something we've started to get kind of used to. And at the beginning of the film, there's another typhoon. The military is mobilizing, getting ready, just in case it's another one of these. The introduction of Godzilla in this one is one of my favorite introductions of Godzilla, because it opens with a weatherman. And there's two levels of weatherman. There's the meteorologist who gets to like stay in the building and just stand in front of a green screen and point and say, "Ah, looks like it's getting pretty humid up in Ventura." But then there's every other weatherman who is the one that you send.
We actually have to go to Ventura.
Yeah, well, it's not even Ventura's bad enough.
But I was about to say. If you live in LA, that saying you have to go to Ventura, that's like you have to go to prison. It's just terrible.
It's not good.
Apologies to all of our listeners who might live in Ventura.
I'm sure there's so many. But the every lower echelon meteorologist, weather person, is the person they send in the middle of an extreme weather scenario.
Hmm.
You can't just get footage and that'll be okay. You have to send some poor schmuck out into a hurricane, out into a tornado, out into the coldest day in American history, out into a volcano. It just got to be like, yeah, but it's pretty bad over here. Why am I here? You're like the ritualistic sacrifice of the network. Like, it just shows that, like, see, we're hardcore.
Well, you know why they have to do that. It's so Dallas Raines can live. They're the human sacrifice.
Yeah, that's why he's still around.
He's still alive.
He will never die.
Dallas Raines is 412 years old.
Dallas Raines is a local meteorologist here in Los Angeles. You'd think he'd be a local meteorologist in Dallas. He is not.
His name is actually Dallas Raines.
Yeah.
And we see his bumpers on TV here in LA a lot.
Yeah.
It's like, more weather's coming. And he's got this like kind of weird voice. And he's like... He's like a game show host vampire. Like, he's got the clean suit, and he's really kind of leathery. He's like, we got more rain coming tonight. And he always holds up a fist and shows off these big fake teeth. He's got, it's coming tonight. It's like, are you threatening me? But he's smiling. It's really... Look up Dallas Raines. Yeah,
nothing but respect for Dallas Raines. No, and let me tell you something.
Look, he is a professional.
Sure. No.
I'm not impugning his profession. He's just kind of a creepy TV presence.
No, there's I think everywhere you go, every city has its local on-air personalities. And, you know, we tend not to think of them as celebrities, but we know who they are.
Yeah. R.I.P. Larry H. Parker, by the way.
Oh, Larry H. Parker died.
Larry H. Parker died. He was a local TV lawyer.
Yeah.
He'd advertise, you know, he was an injury lawyer here in Southern California.
I actually hadn't heard that.
And, yeah, and he was always really angry. He's this guy with, like, glasses, and he just sort of pointed at the camera, "I'll fight for you." He's just really mad all the time.
Yeah, but he was mad on our behalf, so we liked him.
I'm angry you got injured, and you're not getting paid $1 million. I'm going to fight. Yeah. Larry H. Parker passed away today.
That's a shame. I hadn't heard about that. Okay. Well, anyway, that kind of throws a pall over the whole podcast now.
There's no lawyers in the movie, so.
I suppose that's true. So there's this poor meteorologist, and he's like, yeah, it's a big old typhoon. It's pretty bad. And he's like standing in front of the ocean, and you see the whole water recede. It's very intense. And then Godzilla gradually moves upward into the frame behind him. And it's like he had just talked some shit about Godzilla, and then he's like, he's behind me, isn't he? And then he turns around, and Godzilla's like, you trying to start something, bro?
Godzilla, he's behind me. Like he snuck up.
Well, he did. Yeah. He really did. Equating Godzilla to a tidal wave, which this visually does, is so satisfying to me, because that is just one of the ultimate, for me, symbols of impending doom.
Just is a gigantic
tidal
wave.
Well, I used to have nightmares about tidal waves. I was telling you about this. I actually told you about this already, because we recorded this podcast once before.
This is a re-record.
Yeah, it doesn't happen often, but the audio got screwy, and we couldn't use the last bit. So this is a recycled bit, and I apologize. But
I'll have you know that we've been going off on different tangents.
Promise
this time,
you.
So
I promise you.
Getting original content.
80% different tangents. I promise. I think we mentioned Dallas Rains, but other than that, no. But like I used to have recurring nightmares as a kid of tidal waves. That this was like my boogeyman, and I would be on the beach, and the waters would recede really, really far. So they're going to build like this giant tidal wave, and the tidal wave was like 200 feet high. It's like the ending of The Abyss, and or the director's cut of The Abyss. But the thing is, though, is that as the water receded, it would reveal that, like, 40 feet away from the shore, the sand just dipped a lot, like 200 feet, and there are these giant bug monsters living under the sea.
Ooh.
The ocean kind of freaks me out, actually, because, you know, like in movies where, like, you're in a boat and, like, you're in the middle of the ocean and it's like, okay, I gotta just drop in here and, like, grab the life raft. And I'm like, there are monsters under you. You have no idea what kind of creature. There are whales and there are sharks and there are giant squids, and they're all just waiting for you to just drop into the ocean like a bag of Earl Grey. Just... And then, like, the flavor of you starts spreading out, and all the monsters are like, yum, 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 yum. And then they eat you if you don't get out of there fast enough.
I like the idea that every time I get into a tub, I'm making me tea.
Anyway, Godzilla...
Hey, have you seen Saltburn?
Shut up.
Sorry.
Godzilla attacks, and much like at the beginning of Godzilla vs. Megaguirus, we meet one of our protagonists. In this film, her name is Akane. She's played by Yumiko Shaku. And,
It was early in her career. She was like a model before this, and then became an actress.
Yeah, she's good in this. I like her in this a lot. She's a soldier in this anti-Godzilla force. In fact, it's actually, because Godzilla has only attacked the one time, it's actually called the Anti-Megalosaurus Force. She's one of the people in charge of firing those big maser weapons, and she's trying to destroy Godzilla. It doesn't work. In fact, they actually say something kind of weird. When the maser weapon fires, it's like, oh no, it's raining so much. The maser weapon was only like 80% effective. And I'm like, that's a design flaw. They come in typhoons.
Yeah.
We haven't been working on that? What the hell? That's terrible. But in any case...
That's the best they got.
But in any case, it doesn't work. No one is able to do any damage to Godzilla. Godzilla is just too powerful for that. And a bunch of her... co-workers? I guess co-workers.
The other people in the...
Yeah, the people in her squad or platoon, whatever. They die.
And I got the impression that, like, because of that, she was out of the military and was called back in? Like,
not quite. She was... they bring her in to debrief her. Like, saying, okay, so we're not here to blame all of this on you. Pregnant pause. So tell us what happened. And then she says, well, it went... went shitty, didn't it? And then they do blame it all on her. And then they don't throw her out of the military, she basically becomes a librarian for like four years.
And it's worth noting she's like kind of a stoic character. Mm-hmm. She has trouble connecting with people.
Yeah.
She's not like seen in a bar later, like bitter alcoholic.
Yeah, she has
like,
no friends. Yeah, she has no family. She's had to fight for everything she's ever had. She's stoic is a good way to put it. She's a badass. And so for years, she's basically thrown out of the force, but still kept in the military. They didn't kick her out entirely. They just demoted her and gave her no opportunities for advancement. And we see this like montage, this like beginning of Silence of the Lambs montage of like her constantly training in that time, because later on in the movie she will be back and she will team up with Mechagodzilla to fight Godzilla. So we need to show that like she hasn't lost her touch. So there will be a training montage at the beginning. Our other main characters are a scientist and his daughter, which we've seen that dynamic before.
Yeah, and she's like 10, like a young daughter.
Yeah, the mom's out of the picture. She died when the little girl was 4. He is a scientist, and he has a very particular set of skills. And much like Godzilla versus Megaguirus, the government is bringing a whole bunch of brilliant minds together to try to solve a problem. In Megaguirus, they built a black hole gun. Hmm. Here they're going to build that Absolute Zero gun, but they're also going to build a Mechagodzilla. And in order to build a Mechagodzilla,
I love this idea.
They bring in like robot experts, they bring in all kinds of stuff, but there's this guy. And he has, when we meet him, he's got a bunch of like students, and they're looking at a trilobite. And a trilobite, which is kind of like a horseshoe crab, it's supposed to be extinct. And they're like, oh, how is this alive? Well, I took some DNA from similar creatures, and I created them together, and in order to create this very specific exoskeleton, this is basically a cyborg. Mm. In order to recreate an ancient creature, I combined modern genetics and modern robotics to create a cyborg trilobite, which, that is the best science project in the world. Can you imagine whipping that sucker out in junior high?
You are winning that Taco Bell gift certificate, my friend.
Did you ever do a science project when you were a kid? Like a science fair?
No, we didn't have those in my school. I went to like a hippy-dippy private elementary school, so we didn't have like the big gym where everybody got to sort of present their science projects. You just sort of did it for class. Sadly, we weren't ever assigned things like, you know, pour the vinegar in and make the volcano explode. Like we kind of just all did that as a class. I didn't really get to do like a science project. Yeah. We did like invention conventions. That's kind of cool.
What'd you invent?
I did it twice.
You did twice?
Two different years.
It was an annual thing.
So I invented two things. One was a fan. It was a hamster powered fan. I actually had to build this thing. It was a hamster wheel with a fan blade.
I would have gone the reverse and built a fan-powered hamster.
I couldn't build one of those. You actually have to build the thing. Right. So I built it out of my erector set because I had one of those.
That's fun.
And then the following year, I built.
Was a real hamster though?
I didn't have a real hamster.
Okay, so that part was faked. Okay, yeah.
No, I didn't invent a hamster.
No, but like you didn't.
I can't claim invention of the hamster.
I didn't say you invented the hamster. I'm saying did you incorporate an actual hamster into the presentation?
No, if I had owned a hamster, I would have.
Okay, so that was your mistake.
I think I got a prize for like most moving parts. It wasn't anything interesting.
Yeah, we call it the Rube Goldberg Award.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
And the following year, which I didn't win any prizes for, I invented the Melt-O-Matic, where using a mop handle, a skateboard, and an electric heater, I created this device that melts the ice on your front walkway. Just sort of push it very slowly down and it melts the ice.
All right. There's an idea there.
Which is weird because I've grown up in Southern California. I never lived anywhere where there was snow.
We've never shoveled a walk in our lives.
I was over 40 by the time I shoveled snow off of a wall.
Oh, did you really?
Because my mom moved to Denver, so I did it in Denver.
What was it like?
It was very exciting.
Oh my God.
She's like, no, it's a pain in the neck. It's a big chore. It's like, no, this is exciting. Yay, I get to shovel snow. This is cold.
Whitney and I grew up in Southern California. Oh. And then
everyone. By the way, all new tangents.
It's all new tangents. Everyone, wherever you grow up, there are limitations to your experience.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, if you grow up, in the Midwest, you probably don't have a lot of occasions to go to the beach. Maybe a lake, but not like the ocean. So there you go. We didn't have a lot of snow growing up. I didn't see snow in person. Not like on the movies, but in person. Like, I can go outside, like, hey, look at this fucking snow. I didn't see snow in person until I was 20. And I get out of the car.
There is snow here in Southern California. I know. You have to drive into the mountains.
You have to find it. You have to go out of your way. That's my point. You know? It's like... It's like if you want to go to In-N-Out, you do have to brave that drive-through, and if it's not worth the effort, you're not going to go. So I didn't go. We went to my film class, my film school. We all pitched in, and we got a cabin at Mammoth, which is one of the big ski communities. I didn't go skiing because I didn't know how snow worked. But we got out of the car, and there's snow everywhere. It's all white, and it's pretty. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm finally going to get to see snow. And I pick up some snow, and I swear to God, my reaction was, it's cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's frozen.
And that's when Alfred came in and said, it's vichyssoise, sir. It's supposed to be cold. No, because I knew in my head it was supposed to be cold, but whenever I saw it in, like, you know, Calvin and Hobbes comic strips, something like that, they never make a too big a deal out of it being cold. They don't go, like, and if it touched your flesh, it would get really rosy. Like, thank you. That would have been very useful for me to sort of understand the concept. Didn't work out. But that's neither here nor there. Godzilla attacks. Akane is our protagonist. She fails. She gets demoted. And this cyborg guy, the cyborg scientist, is recruited, along with a bunch of other scientists, for a project. His daughter, who hasn't really been processing her mother's death great. She believes that her mother has, in true Biollante fashion, and maybe this is a reference, her mother's soul has, like, found its way into her, what was it called
again? It's a potted plant. It's a certain kind of fern or grass.
Yeah, that actually, it's a fern, yeah.
It's a fern that actually responds to touch.
Yeah, and really it's cool.
And it's a real
those.
Plant. Like it, and
sleeping grass.
Sleeping grass. You kind of stroke your thumb along the
it, like, contracts
the blades, and it slowly closes. It, not, like, tightly like a Venus flytrap or anything, but, yeah, kind of closes.
Similar premise, though, to a Venus flytrap.
And they do that really to really cool effects. There's a scene where the girl's talking to the plant. She's like, hey, what do you think, Mom? And clearly, like, some stagehand rub their thumb on it so we get to see it, like, kind of close and move on its own. It's not a special effect.
No, it's very
just
cool.
The plant just moved on its own.
But she's very plucky. She has strong opinions about things, and the dad initially turns it down because he doesn't want to be separated from her because he's a single dad. And she says, just take me with you. And he's like, ah. And then the government says, no, she can come to our top secret military installation and just hang out. And it's like, really? Like, yeah, we have no standards. So it's like, okay, cool. And there's this cute scene where we cut to, like, after she's, like, in the, after they've moved, she's walking home from school with a bunch of kids. And they're all kind of talking about this, like, secret government installation that's in their neighborhood and how I heard that they're building this so-and-so and I hear they're building a thing with UFOs or whatever. And she's like, oh, that's really, really great. Well, this is my stop. This is the secret government installation. Yep. And then the soldier at the front gate salutes her and she walks in and she's the coolest kid in the school.
It was pretty, I would hold that over my friends.
Oh, my God.
I would be that asshole. Did you watch the subtitled version or the dubbed version?
Oh, it's the dubbed version.
Okay. The dubbing on the kids is terrible.
Oh, yeah, it's quite bad.
It's a pretty common practice in voice acting to have children voiced by adult women.
Yeah.
When you have a talented voice actress, getting your Tress McNeils, your June Forays.
Sure.
Sounds great.
Yeah. They know what they're doing.
I feel like the voice actors they got to do the kids didn't know they'd be doing kids that day.
Ah.
Like, they came in, okay, you're playing, like, a 10-year-old. Oh, crap.
I lied on my application. I've actually never played a kid in a movie before.
Okay.
Fake it till you make it, I guess.
You make Godzilla, are you?
Would you like to play hopscotch after class? It's not that bad, but it is a little distracting. The voice acting isn't actually too bad in the dub, though, I gotta say.
No, I mean,
generally speaking.
They are professionals, but you know that a lot of the voice actors have to play multiple roles whenever they're dubbing something, and sometimes it's not a role they're... hold about until, like, very shortly before they have to record. So they have to come up with something, like, on the drive on the way over.
Yeah. In any case, so... Their plan, though, the big plan, you might have guessed it's a Mechagodzilla plan, but the plan isn't just to build a giant mecha. Hmm. The plan is to build it around the actual skeleton of the original Godzilla, which they have dug up from the ocean depths, and they've brought into their facility, and they brought it into the facility still in water for some reason. Which is weird. It's a cool image, but it doesn't make any sense.
This was after Titanic, and we learned, like, remember they brought that drawing up, but they kept it underwater, because if they fished it out, it would fall apart. So they kept it wet. Same, I think it's the same principle.
Okay, that's a very fragile skeleton. But in any case, they're going to use
this is Godzilla's the DNA. The same Godzilla skeleton, the one from 1954, still on the ocean's floor, having been destroyed by the oxygen destroyer back in the 50s.
Yeah, and now they're going to reassemble that and then build on top of that a whole bunch of robot stuff. And underneath the robot stuff, they're going to use Godzilla's DNA as sort of like the musculature and the structure. And then also create a DNA-powered computer brain. And the idea is most computers, or pretty much all computers, work on a binary code system, a one or a zero, a yes or a no. A DNA system, because DNAs are comprised of Gattaca, GATC. Yeah, those are like the four components of...
It's where they got the title Gattaca, they use those letters.
It's got four possibilities instead of two, and that makes it more powerful. And I'm just going to trust you on that, because I don't remember science.
Well, there's a lot of dialogue about how... I think they keep on calling it like a DNA computer,
and which is really just a brain if you think about it. Yeah. Our brains are basically computers.
Yeah, I've heard some people say human beings are nothing more than information embedded in meat.
You know what? It's a damn good computer, actually.
I mean, mine shorts out. Like,
They all short out after a while. You know, there's a reason your warranty expires on your laptop.
You can't remember your seventh grade science classes, but sing to me the DuckTales theme song right now. I bet you can.
Life is like a mystery here in DuckTales. Oh, DuckBurg. Sorry,
There you go.
Problem solved.
Maybe it was a bad example. Yeah. Then life is like a hurricane here in DuckBurg.
Oh my god, life is like a hurricane, just like a Godzilla.
Race cars, lasers,
airplanes,
mazers, and Super X3s.
Yeah, it's
Godzilla blur.
Yeah,
they don't really solve a mystery or rewrite,
history.
But they rewrote history in Godzilla versus King Ghidorah.
They rewrite Godzilla history in every single one of these millennia.
That's true, and they're constantly rewriting history.
Yeah.
I'm not going to continue with this DuckTales shit.
No, we're done with that. We're done with them. But
basically
Mechagodzilla is a cyborg in this case.
And our main character is going to be the pilot.
Yeah.
There's a big portion of the movie where they're building this thing. They're talking about what it's capable of. There's a great demonstration of the Absolute Zero Ray.
Yeah.
And
it like freezes something and then it like shatters into a million pieces. Yeah. Like the T-1000 and T2.
Essentially dissolves. Like it just kind of turns into ice particles.
Yeah.
And the main character, Akane, during the process of like all of this testing, she actually gets to talk to the young girl and the scientist for a little bit.
They bond a little bit.
And they sort of start to form this ersatz family.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's going to be a scene later in the movie where all of these scenes start to become really important to her. That she was ousted from her position before, and she actually has a bit of an arc, because by the end, she's going to have this new kind of family unit, these new friends to fight for.
And indeed, she is actually ostracized from all of her fellow Mechagodzilla soldier pilots because she was blamed for getting all of his other soldiers killed when Godzilla attacked 5 years ago. And, she takes it. She blames herself as well. And she's just like, you know what? Mm. They got a point. I'm not even going to fight it. But there's a moment where the scientist guy is trying to, like, just have lunch with her. He likes her a little bit. He's got a little bit of a crush. And she's kind of being standoffish about it. But then this guy comes in, this guy who, like, hates her because he blames her for getting his brother killed. And he's giving her shit. And then he gives the scientist shit. And that's one took over the line until he grabs his wrist. And she's just like, okay, you can fuck with me all you want, but come on. Have some respect. He's building a giant Godzilla cyborg for you. Let's keep our shit together.
I like that he's building a giant Godzilla cyborg, and he thinks it's neat.
It is neat.
I'm building Mechagodzilla. Yes, you are.
Do you remember in The Tick and how there was this one speech that they used to have, because The Tick was remembering, like, all the old superheroes in the 1940s, and they would do things like, oh, yes, and then, you know, the Kremlin turned into a giant rocket, and it just flew away. And Arthur's like, that's not true. That couldn't possibly happen. That science doesn't work that way. And Dick's like, no, you don't understand. Back in the old days, science would move in great big leaps, and now everything is just molecules, molecules, molecules.
Not so wrong. Mm-hmm. I've heard it said before that human technology kind of takes turns in the way it advances. Like, it's not that everything advances at once. And for the last several generations, it's been microtechnology, computers, smartphones, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But for a while there was all macro technology, inventing cars and rockets and trains. Yeah. You know, the technology that moves us across the planet.
Like, we thought, like, all of our old science fiction assumed that by the end of the 20th century, we'd be living in, you know, buildings on the clouds and shit.
Well, because we assumed that macro technology would continue to evolve. We didn't predict that we'd make a shift to micro technology.
Within people's lifetimes at that time, we had gone from cars being either non-existent or pretty rare to literally paving over the whole planet just to make cars more accessible.
Yeah.
And, by the way, that was a huge fucking mistake in a variety of ways. But regardless, we did it. We did it fast.
We were just a little over-enthusiastic.
Yes. But we did it fast, was my point. It could have happened. But instead, we just started to make everything smaller. There's going to come a day when we have, like, a micro-Godzilla movie.
I was going to say, we could have Mechagodzilla by now. Damn it.
Right? No. We had to get your fucking iPad.
Yeah. I think that's why there were so many people who were really keen on Elon Musk.
Oh, yeah, because it seemed like he was doing the big stuff.
Like, he was going to be doing cars and rockets again. It's like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
We have
another... cars.
We have a macro technology innovator, and then we learned about Elon Musk.
Yeah, and how he basically just bought other people's shit and put his name on it and took a lot of credit.
And then he started talking in public and realized that he's an idiot.
And then there's all these Nazis on Twitter now. Like, I mean, they were there before, but now they're gaining power. And it's like, oh, my God. I remember the day the worm started to turn because there was a joke like, oh yeah, Elon Musk is going to release like a flamethrower for like consumer use. And everyone's like, okay, well that's clearly like an April Fool's Day thing, right? No, he actually did that. And all it was the exact same thing that like people use to like burn leaves.
Yeah,
but he just called it a flamethrower.
It's a flame jet weeder. We've had him for decades.
And once you realize that, like, that's where his mind is at, he's like a 10-year-old, you're like, oh, he's just rich. That's what we're dealing with.
He's rich. No one's told him no.
Yeah.
And he legitimately thinks he's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's a problem with a lot of those rich guys, guys in power. Like, they think they're doing a good job.
I think Steve Jobs ruined that, because Steve Jobs was an idea guy. He actually wasn't, like, a science guy. He just had good ideas for the most part. Mm. But that gave everyone this idea that all you gotta do is be rich and have an idea, and then you're brilliant. Yeah. And no. But there's a great bit in Glass Onion where... Ed Norton plays a billionaire idea guy like Elon Musk, like Steve Jobs, and he would like, he has one guy, and his whole job is in the middle of the night, he'll like fax him an idea, and it's just, make this a thing. It's like when people put on Twitter, is this a thing? And that's what it would be. It would be like, smart toilet paper. And it's like, I don't know if this is genius or stupid. I have no idea.
And it's always stupid.
It's almost always stupid. But, like, yeah, regardless. Yeah. Anyway, you're going to stumble into something halfway cognizant, halfway cogent. But, anyway.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
I wish we lived in a world where we could have Mechagodzilla, but unfortunately...
Well, we'd have to have Godzilla first, and we'd have to have Godzilla first.
And then you take it stock of the big fight that happens at the end of this movie between Godzilla and Mechagodzilla, and a lot of shit gets wrecked.
Yeah.
It's... We talked about how dynamically filmed the fights were in Godzilla vs. Megaguirus. Mm-hmm. You know, this giant flying bug. It's really bright and open. The camera stays way back. And there's
they come up with unique choreography, like things that had never been done in a Godzilla movie before.
Was that the one where he has the prehensile tail and he's like wraps
I think that
his
might
enemy
have been.
Around? It might have been Godzilla.
They start to blur a little bit, but yeah, that's one of the cool. It was like, yeah.
Just good fight choreography that's really well staged. This one takes place at night, but they're just blasting light all over the set.
Yeah, it looks
cool. You can see everything.
It looks fun. I don't need night to look like real night in movies.
No, I'm fine. It's okay to have a spotlight.
I
want to
see
action.
Shit.
So black background, really well, like clear visuals, and Mechagodzilla and Godzilla have at it in the most spectacular possible way.
It's pretty
way.
Damn great.
There's Mechagodzilla has. I'm skipping ahead a little.
You're skipping ahead a lot, actually. But
Mechagodzilla has a jetpack that he like. Weaponizes, throws at Godzilla, and Godzilla gets knocked back a little bit.
That's
it's really
fun.
Cool looking.
Yeah.
But before that fight can happen, we have to get Mechagodzilla to the fight.
Well, actually, there's an initial... Okay, so here's the deal. Godzilla attacked the opening movies in, like, 1999. We cut ahead to the year the movie is released, and Godzilla...
2002.
A few years later, and Mechagodzilla has been created, and Godzilla, to his credit... was a good enough sport to hang back until Mechagodzilla was done. Because Godzilla doesn't attack again until literally the day they reveal Mechagodzilla to the world. Yeah. The day. And then Godzilla's like, oh, that's my cue. It's almost like it's like a publicity thing that they planned in advance. And Godzilla starts like, okay, here we go. Bum, 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 bum. Actually, I don't think they use any of the original music in this one.
No, they don't They don't have the old theme in this
one. But he shows up. And they have to get Mechagodzilla to Godzilla. And they don't want to waste fuel because Mechagodzilla only has so much power. It uses a lot of it, as you can imagine. Yeah. And they have this, like, device that can, like, shoot microwaves at Mechagodzilla and repower it if they need to. This will kind of only come into play later. But regardless, you don't want to, like, waste all of Mechagodzilla's energy getting him to the fight. Hmm. Like Sam Elliott and Ghost Rider. Like, you don't... You just want to get in there. So they... That's
something we brought up on our first recording.
We did, didn't we? Yeah.
It was a little upsetting because in the movie Ghost Rider, Nicolas Cage is a living tattoo, essentially. It's a skull... has a flaming skull head and flies on a flaming motorcycle and he fights the devil.
It's a cool image. Yeah. Not a great movie.
Cool-looking... creature.
I'm quite fond of the second one, actually.
That one's really crazy.
Yeah, that was fun.
It's revealed late in that movie that Sam Elliott is also a ghostwriter, and it has been for like centuries.
Yeah.
And in fact, he's been a ghostwriter so long he's a cowboy ghostwriter.
Yeah.
So he gets the flaming skull head with like a cool cowboy hat. Yeah. He gets on a horse with flaming hooves.
It's a flaming horse.
Yeah, it's like really
so
cool.
Awesome.
And there's this really awesome
horse.
Shot, and they have this cover of Ghost Rider in the sky as they blast across the desert going to face the devil.
Yeah.
They end
motorcycle
up this, like,
Ghost
little...
Rider, horse Ghost Rider. Awesome. And then they get to where the final confrontation is going to be. They're going to fight literally the son of Lucifer himself. Mm. And when they get there, Sam Elliott says, well, that's it for me. Like, what?
No.
I only had enough power left for one last ride. And I'm like, well, maybe you should have waited until we got here. What was that even for?
Here,
just for companionship?
Hook up a horse trailer to Ghost Rider's motorcycle.
Well, how did you help? That didn't help. It just looked cool for a second.
Just like one cool scene, and that's it.
I would love it. Wouldn't that be great if like there was like Mission Impossible 9 or whatever the fuck it is, like Tom Cruise meets up with like the original, like the first spy who was ever there for like Mission Impossible, and it's like some cool get, like I don't know who would be like a cool.
Well, they have cool gets in those movies all the time.
Okay,
so
but like I'm just trying to think like who would be like, oh my god, that'd be so awesome, like who was big and like,
you know who it is? It's Roger Corman. Roger Corman was the first spy.
No.
Roger Corman's like 97 years old.
No. You know what they get? They get Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, there you go.
Pierce Brosnan comes in, and he was the original Mission Impossible spy. And it's like, oh my god, you're a legend. This is awesome. Like, we're going to save the day together and do all these cool stunts. And then Pierce Brosnan drives Tom Cruise there, opens the door, and says, get out.
Yeah.
And then just drives away. Kind of a waste of a cameo. I don't know why we did it. Anyway, they need to bring Mechagodzilla to the fight. And in order to do that, and I think this is something... I don't remember what the first anime was I saw this in. I think it might have been Neon Genesis Evangelion, but they basically take Harrier jets and connect them to Mechagodzilla and lift Mechagodzilla into the air. And they fly Mechagodzilla to where Godzilla is attacking. And what's I like what they do with this, though, because they acknowledge that that's a hell of an image and that everyone they fly past would have to, like, sort of just stop and regard that.
Yeah.
No one goes about their day when you just see a Mechagodzilla fly across you know?
There's a great scene, and I mentioned this in our first recording, where Mechagodzilla is flying past that baseball game.
Mm-hmm. Looks like the shots from Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. And there's just, like, a bunch of kids there, and the coach is looking
the
up.
Movie,
and,
by the way. Yeah.
And there's... And there's just a moment where the kids just sort of stop and say, oh, cool, look at that, and get to see Mechagodzilla flying past.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of got a very visceral memory of, like, seeing the Goodyear blimp as a kid. It's like, oh, look, there it is.
Yeah, that's cool.
You kind of stop when you're a little kid. You're excited about seeing
it. And I like that scene because I think it's really useful in a movie about something kind of wondrous.
To show wonderment?
Well, it's important because the characters who built Mechagodzilla, they might still be impressed by it, but they're not going to be dazzled just by the sight of it. That's where they work every day.
Yeah.
To suddenly see this wondrous thing from the perspective of someone to whom it is new helps remind us in the audience of how special it is. A great example of this is Batman Begins. We spent, like, the first, like, 30, 40 minutes of the movie with Batman's origin. We haven't actually seen him in a bat costume being Batman. The first time we see him, like, fight a whole bunch of, like, criminals in, like, a warehouse or something, or, like, the stockyards, the perspective for, like, the first time, for, like, a meaningful amount of time, shifts away from Bruce Wayne.
Uh-huh.
And now, that whole sequence where Batman attacks is from the perspective of the goons.
Yeah,
and it's just how fucking terrifying it would be.
The nameless thugs,
you've never dealt with anything like this before, and now some weirdo in a cape is, like, leaping on everybody and beating the shit out of them, and it's like, that would freak you out. That was not supposed to happen today. So if the audience is fully aware of all this Batman shit. They're not. To them, it's new.
Mm.
And showing it from their perspective makes the scene a little punchier, and that works. A bit of a trivia, though, about the baseball scene you just mentioned is that there's a cameo in that scene from a baseball player named Hideki Matsui, who has a nickname, and his nickname was Gojira.
Isn't that great?
So they got Gojira to do a cameo in this Gojira movie. And I think that's adorable.
They probably got some... Toho got so many letters.
Oh,
you should put this baseball player in your movie.
Yeah. Well, it paid off, didn't it? And then good for them. They drop Mechagodzilla into the city, and they're going to, like, have Mechagodzilla fight Godzilla. And Godzilla... And this has got to be fucking weird for Godzilla. Can you imagine if you're going about your business, just doing your day job, you know, knocking over buildings, and all of a sudden, a bunch of little helicopters drop a giant robot version of you? like just down, like, a block away, and you're like, the fuck?
And Godzilla rolls with, like, there are a few moments in through all these movies we've been seeing where Godzilla's a little nonplussed.
Yeah.
It's like, duh?
What?
What is that?
That's, like, weird. And Godzilla very reasonably, I feel, roars at Mechagodzilla. And Mechagodzilla responds in a way I wasn't expecting. He freaks out and starts destroying the city. Because it turns out that because the interior of Mechagodzilla is a lot of Godzilla parts, Godzilla's roar reminded Mechagodzilla that whatever other function it serves and whatever other tech is inside of it, it's a Godzilla.
Yeah.
And it started acting like a Godzilla, and they had to shut it down. And it went really bad, and now everyone has egg on their face because, like, oh, that was not how that was supposed to go at all. Whoops.
For a minute, it looks like that the two might team up. Like, Godzilla and Mechagodzilla will, like, start destroying things together.
Awesome.
But we can't have that.
Well, that's not the goal, anyway.
Godzilla and Mechagodzilla are not friends.
Look, I used to say that about Godzilla and King Kong, and I think in the next movie they high-five or something.
They high-five, and King Kong has a power glove.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see that shitty movie.
God.
It's going to be amazing.
Oh, my God. We went from an Oscar-winning Godzilla Minus One to this one that looks like
like super schlock kind of thing.
Like,
yeah.
It looks like it was written by, like, an 8-year-old the way that the Jet Jaguar one does. It's just like, oh, my God, please, just plug it into my veins.
It turns out there's an evil King Kong now, and they have to team up to fight him, and they have a power
glove. Has there ever been a moment where, like, a movie won an Academy, like a prestigious Academy Award? I mean, I realize it's special visual effects, but still, that's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. Godzilla's never won an Oscar before. And then within a month, there's another sequel, remake, or something that's just nonsense. It would be like, right after The Godfather Part 2 won the Academy Award for Best Picture, and everyone's like, oh my god, it's the greatest movie ever made. 1 month later, there was like an Airplane-style parody of it. It would just be like, well, oh, weird.
I can't think of that. I know there was the year Halle Berry won an Academy Award for her role in Monsters Ball.
Yeah.
The same year she won a Razzie for her role in Catwoman.
Yes. And it was right
next to each other. Good for her, she showed up to accept her Razzie.
Yep.
And she gave a really impact, like, she's a very good actress, so she gave this very kind of, like, fake teary speech about it. It takes a lot of work to make a piece of garbage like Catwoman. Good for her.
Sandra Bullock also won a Razzie the same year she won an Oscar. And she also picked up her Academy Award.
It was All About Steve,
All
right?
About Steve, I think, was the film.
And The Blind Side.
And The Blind Side. Yeah, and she also picked up a Razzie Award. So kudos to them. But the one I was thinking of was just when Eddie Murphy, everyone thought he was going to win an Academy Award for Dreamgirls, and then a month before the Oscars came out, Norbit came out, and all of his newfound credibility just kind of like, I don't know if that actually did it, but the tale told over Hollywood was that it did. Do we really want to? It feels like we're giving an Oscar to Norbit, like maybe, yeah. Norbit, by the way, Academy Award nominated movie.
That's true, for makeup.
Yeah, it's true. So, because joke's on you.
Eddie Murphy
very respectable.
Played the both lead roles. I think if the American Godzilla makers really wanted to be kind of mercenary about it,
yeah,
they would have pushed forward Godzilla X Kong to before the Academy Awards.
They might not have wanted to pull a Norbit.
Clunky, schlocky thing. Maybe we can undercut the chances of the Japanese Godzilla movie.
Why would you want that, though? A Godzilla movie winning an Oscar, and then you've got a Godzilla movie in theater a couple of weeks later.
That's probably the thinking.
Especially considering that Godzilla Minus One isn't currently available. There was this whole thing online, like, why isn't Godzilla Minus One available to see right now? Because it's in the period between when it's in theaters and home video.
It's going to be home video in May.
Like, why is that so hard to wrap your head around? I mean, it would be nice if it was online right now. We could all see it, but...
Just wait a second.
Yeah.
It's logical for us because we grew up in an era where you had to wait literally 1 year before you could see a film on home video.
It was not uncommon for a movie to come out in theaters, and Blockbusters were prevalent, and you couldn't rent it for 9 months to a year. It was very, very common.
9 months was quick turnaround.
Yeah. Yeah.
To see a new picture that you missed in theaters.
And with the idea that because it was absent, it would be special to have it now. Like, oh god, remember when Jurassic Park came out? Oh my god, it's finally on home video! This is amazing!
And that's why home video sales were so high.
Yeah.
People were eager to see those things.
Yeah. And then they started shrinking it under the philosophy that... Well, we just spent all that money on publicity. Do we really want to spend it again? Mm. So we'll make it like 6 months and then 3 months. And now Lisa Frankenstein is already streaming and it's been like 1 month.
Yeah.
Feels a little fast.
That's weird for us.
But it's a little weird, honestly. Like, you don't want to like...
Like a theatrical window, and as soon as the theatrical window closes, they open it on home video. Well, that's the schedule now.
We killed one-third of the Golden Goose when we took away physical media.
Yeah.
Because... It used to be, it was in theaters, you waited, it hit physical media. And then you would buy it, because now, oh, yes, I've been wanting for so long.
Or you rent it,
but you paid money for it. And then, after a while, it would be on cable, or streaming, or whatever. Now we just skip the part where you pay a lot of money a second time for one specific thing, and now, like, 1/1,000th of your prescription, your subscription to HBO Max is, I guess, goes to that.
Yeah.
As because you're paying for all of it at once. That's just weird. I don't know why we thought that was a good idea. But anyway, Mechagodzilla. Total wash. Everyone's embarrassed. Not sure if they're going to continue with the project. They got to fix it right away. And of course, they do. very quickly. It's kind of a thing where it's like, do we think the movie's over? No, then they're going to fix Mechagodzilla. That's why we're here. They're fixing Mechagodzilla. There's a few more scenes with Akane and the scientist and the daughter. And Akane, by the way, I love her as a character. She gives one of the worst speeches I've ever heard an adult give to a kid in a movie. It's like right alongside with like the grandparent at the beginning of Silent Night, Deadly Night, when like he just suddenly tells the kid, Santa Claus kills people at Christmas. Don't tell anyone. What? Like that level of like not good. Because Akane is basically
trying is the first step to failure.
Yeah, hold on, let me I wrote it down because Akane said some really terrible things. Akane is talking to a 9-year-old and says, nobody is going to miss me when I'm gone. I should never have been born at all. The kid's like 9. That's a lot.
It's pretty
especially, and her mom is dead.
Hefty nihilism.
And her mom is dead, and she's struggling to deal with this. Maybe don't unload all that on a little kid, but the little kid is like, no, all life is precious. And Akane is basically like, oh, I never thought of it that way before. Interesting. I'll reconsider my life. She does. Anyway, Godzilla attacks again. Because it's his movie. And all of a sudden, it's like, okay, wait, do we even try this Mechagodzilla thing? And there's a little bit of a will there, won't they? But they will. It's manufactured tension. And they get into... By the way, Akane doesn't pilot Mechagodzilla from inside Mechagodzilla. It's like they're piloting them from like these like Harrier jets like around it. Mechagodzilla and Godzilla come together, and they fight a lot. And it's awesome. A bunch of cool shit happens. And then Mechagodzilla gets pretty wrecked. Like, it's pretty bad. Mm. And they think, oh, God, this all fell apart again. What are we going to do? And they even tried, like, the Absolute Zero weapon, but Godzilla unleashed his radioactive breath and, like, basically, like, shot it as it was firing, and that ruined everything.
Not in the way where they, like, meet in the middle and like, start... Like... Which I've complained about before.
But... No. Just messed up the device. So Mechagodzilla is down. They can't control Mechagodzilla. It doesn't have enough power. And Akane gets out of her jet, crawls down to Mechagodzilla, climbs inside of it, and is going to pilot it from the inside like you're supposed to.
But you know what? I like that moment.
Yeah.
It increases tension. It increases the risk for the characters. Yeah. It's good... movie writing.
I maintain that all the best mecha is piloted from inside the mecha. That's kind of the whole thing. We see it as like sort of an extension of the person inside it.
Well, it's also, you know, if you are a little kid and you dream of driving, that's just the next best thing, isn't it? You get to pilot a giant robot.
The next best thing. It's the best thing is to drive a fucking mecha. My God. I still maintain that the coolest like version of this was when they turned King Ghidorah into Cyborg King Ghidorah.
Yeah.
That they just knew how to film that shit. All the levers and shit were really cool. Here it's interesting though, because she's inside, she's piloting it, and when it doesn't quite work right, she yells at Mechagodzilla to work with her on this, and Mechagodzilla's like, okay.
So
Mechagodzilla,
it's been established that it's like
it's alive,
semi-conscious.
Yeah, well, it has a DNA computer brain made out of Godzilla DNA. It has some life to it. Yeah. And she has to connect with something alive in order to save the day, which is kind of not in her wheelhouse. Yeah. So that's kind of like character development. It's thin, but it works.
This is all going to depend on how much you project onto Mechagodzilla, because none of this is explained. But yeah. My impression was that this was just kind of...
a zombie.
Very basic biologic function. It wasn't like Mechagodzilla had... A consciousness, necessarily. Yeah. Like, it's only vaguely, like, a shred of consciousness. Like, like however much is left of Murphy in RoboCop. Like, that guy's...
We disagree about how much is left of Murphy in RoboCop, by the way.
I think Murphy's, like, more or less gone. Like, he's dead. And
no,
and
I don't think so.
All that's left is just, like, basic brain functions.
I think that's what I get about RoboCop. I think in the last act of RoboCop disputes that, but I think RoboCop 2 and 3 supports your definition.
Yeah.
So I think
when he says, what's your name? And he says, Murphy. I don't think that's like, I remember being Murphy. It was, I remember that I was a human being before I was turned into this steel golem.
I think he hasn't got it all back, but I think he's Murphy. But we're going to let that go. They have to recharge Mechagodzilla. By the way, Mechagodzilla recharges faster than my phone. Look, in like 2002. Like, it's pretty impressive.
I think it is set in the near future.
No, but not much. Like, I think they said it was only like 5 years after 1994. So, like...
Oh, well, maybe
yeah.
not. Okay.
So Kane is inside Mechagodzilla, and the climactic fight is fucking awesome. Godzilla is going to unleash his radioactive breath again, and this guy who had been at odds with Akane flies his ship into Godzilla's mouth so that to prevent Godzilla from using his radioactive breath and give Akane a chance. And he just tells her, fire, just I don't care if I die, I'll make this heroic sacrifice. And as she's charging up the Absolute Zero weapon, she also uses rockets to like power slide into Godzilla so she can fire it off. A, she can fire it off at point blank range. B, she can pull the ship out of Godzilla's mouth. The ship flies out. The guy ejects just 1 second before the ship explodes. Awesome shot.
it's really fun.
And then, to prevent Godzilla from attacking, and I've never seen anyone do this, grabs Godzilla's mouth and holds it closed while she is powering Godzilla away from the city so she can use the Zero weapon. And
it's so cool.
And then they land in the ocean and the Zero weapon goes off and there's this gigantic mountain of ice that just shoots out of the ocean. And you're like, oh my god, that's the most epic Godzilla death we have ever seen. Godzilla's fine, by the way.
Godzilla's more or less indestructible.
Yeah.
We've learned this. I love that there has been one film where Godzilla's been definitively dead, where we saw his skeleton.
And it's the first one.
And it's the first one.
Yeah. And they learned their lesson.
And every time they have to bring that up, they say, and Dr. Sarazawa, like they bring up his name all the time. He had developed this weapon, but he died and he took all of his research with him.
Yep.
So we can't ever do that again.
Yep.
Which, good plot contrivance.
That's fine. Yeah, it works. It's what he wanted.
But it is what he wanted.
So it preserves the integrity of that ending.
Nobody else
in
50 years was able to come up with anything remotely similar.
No, we kind of did it once, but anyway, it's regardless. We're all trying to come up with a better...
I guess he was definitively dead also in Godzilla vs. Destoroyah, where he saw him melt.
That's true, but we did have a replacement Godzilla at the end, so that was nice. Godzilla is alive. He is worse for the wear. He's got like some chunks ripped out of him. And Godzilla basically taps out. He's like, you know what? You wanted it more today. And I'm gonna go.
Uh-huh.
Kudos. Kudos. And Godzilla walks off into the sunset. And Akane, awesome shot, gets out of Mechagodzilla, stands on Mechagodzilla's shoulder, and looks out at the sunset as Godzilla runs away.
From behind, she's like leaning up against, she's in the foreground.
And the credits roll over her. She's over Mechagodzilla's shoulder. The credits roll over, Godzilla's over her shoulder, and the credits roll over Godzilla. Great ending. Great fucking ending. And there's a post-credit scene. And the post-credit scene is actually not... like super cheesy. It's actually like kind of, we're back at home base. We're sort of meeting up with the scientist and the little girl, and the implication is they're going to go out on a date. It concludes. Oh, there's also, by the way, I think there's like a cameo from the director. I think he like walks by the screen. But the final actual shot of the movie is actually kind of sweet. She's walking away. There's Mechagodzilla being repaired in the background, and she turns and she salutes Mechagodzilla. kudos, Mechagodzilla. Well done indeed. You nailed it.
I would salute Mechagodzilla.
I would salute the shit out of Mechagodzilla. Especially this Mechagodzilla. I love this Mechagodzilla.
Yeah. I mean, I like all the versions of Mechagodzilla. Even the American version. We'll get to the American pretty soon, actually. We're coming up on the monster.
We've only got one or two more movies.
There's two films left in the Millennium Era.
Yeah, and then we get into the legendary Monsterverse.
Yeah.
And then there's more. They have the anime movies or Shin Godzilla. Like, it's not just legendary Monsterverse movies, but seriously, we'll get there within a month. That's weird.
Yeah. And those movies are only 10 years old, so we're catching up on the present real fast.
We're catching up. By the end of the summer, this podcast will be... Not by the end, but like the beginning of the summer.
Yeah.
We'll be moving on. And we do have plans for other things, by the way, so just so you know.
I do love how... Think back to that first American Godzilla in the Monsterverse movie.
No, the Gareth Edwards version.
The Gareth Edwards film.
Yeah.
and how, like, they tried to give it a really somber tone. Yeah. So they're really trying to make it into the serious blockbuster.
Yeah.
And we fast forward 6 films and we have King Kong with a robot glove.
To be fair, the first Gojira was very serious as well.
Yeah.
Fast forward 6 films, we've got Mechanic Kong.
Exactly. Like we can't help ourselves.
No, we can't.
Like, no, we have to take Godzilla seriously.
For a minute. Every few years, we're going to do it seriously, and then we're going to go, right? It's like James Bond. Mm. We're going to do GoldenEye, Casino Royale, one kind of grounded one that feels like kind of like takes place in the real world, and then a couple of films later, the wackiest shit we can think of.
We got Invisible Cars, James Bond infected with nanites that will only kill his wife. Like,
oh, no, only kill his daughter. And it's like,
only his daughter.
Like, and that was the sad, serious ending. That was the stupid. Like, what?
Fucking nanites? That's your serious ending?
My God.
No Time to Die is shit.
It's not a good movie. Oh my God. Boy, was the Daniel Craig's franchise just up and down. Wasn't that?
I kind of hope he doesn't come back.
I don't think he will.
I want James Bond to just be gone.
Like oh, James Bond. You want James Bond to be gone.
James Bond can. We don't need a next James Bond. James Bond was done in the 90s.
Here's what I would like. I think this would be fun if you want to keep James Bond going. Because didn't like Amazon buy the rights?
Yeah, they bought MGM.
Here's what you do. Keep the movies on ice for a while.
Uh-huh.
What you do is you do a TV series about other 007s after James Bond dies. Okay, like Lashana Lynch is like James Bond for like 1 or 2 seasons.
Okay.
And then when she wants to leave or whatever, you Doctor Who it. There's a new 007. Oh, someone else gets
perfect.
Yeah. And then you can have a different tone for each different 007 that comes in. That would be really, really fun. And if you only do like, I don't know, like 6 episodes per season, you can spend all the money on them. They can pretty epic. Great. We don't need James Bond. Let it be 007.
Yeah.
And then if you ever want to bring James Bond back, you reboot it with a big old movie. Everyone's like, hey, James Bond is back.
Yeah.
But wait a little while. Mm. You can keep it going, but wait on James Bond. That's my pitch. Give me money. Please give me money. Anyway, Godzilla against Mechagodzilla. This is one of my favorite movies in the series. It's really tight.
It's really... This one and Godzilla vs. Megaguirus are actually really good. I recall, and I've commented on this before, the first time I watched the Millennium Era, I found them to be, like, so dour in contrast to the Heisei Era, which was a little bit more... like
it's kind of intense, dude, ready, actually.
But, pardon?
His era was pretty intense, actually.
Well, now that I'm rewatching it, I don't know why I came to that conclusion. Because the Millennium movies are just as goofy. And they're actually, like, some of them are pretty bright and fun. And this one and Megaguirus are actually, like, legit good Godzilla pictures. Maybe it's because they're so inconsistent. The Millennium Era, compared to all the others, is really kind of staggering a little bit. I think they didn't really know how to handle Godzilla at this point. And
it's an anthology series at this point, basically.
It's an anthology series, and it could be another instance of, like, post 9/11 malaise, or just millennial malaise in general.
Do with this after?
Like, this is a creature that's going to show a lot of, like, destruction. Can we have fun with destruction, you know, in the years following
9/11? I mean, that's the arc of Godzilla, though. It wasn't fun to begin with, and then eventually we got just enough distance. We can now turn this thing that was a very sober allegory into something kind of goofy and fun. Weird that we ever did that, but it happens.
I feel like 2002 was a really strange year for blockbusters because we still had a lot of the old destruction-heavy blockbusters still sort of made, but they hadn't been released yet.
Yeah, they were in the can or they were almost done, and so like we're kind of stuck with them, but it was like, do we want that right now? And so kind of we didn't, actually.
There were a couple movies. One of them was James Bond, Die Another Day, came out in 2002. That was like, what are we doing here?
Like, this doesn't feel like how James Bond would react to the present situation. It felt old.
It was already dated, and we released it anyway. Same with The Sum of All Fears, the Phil Alden Robinson, Jack Ryan movie.
I would argue that one felt like too on the nose.
Well, the point was, prior to 9/11, it's going to feel a lot different.
In
2002, it means something different now.
That movie's actually aged very well.
Now it has.
Yeah, and even its whole theory about how, like, white supremacy would come back and try to, like, take over the world. When that movie came out, they changed that from the book. That wasn't in the book. And they were just, like, there was the whole scheme to get America and Russia to fight each other was a plot from Nazis, basically. And I remember critics at the time saying, like Nazis are going to come back. And now I'm like, we maybe should have paid attention to some of our fears instead of writing it off. Because, whoops.
Pressure. No.
Shit. Anyway.
But yeah, and I think Godzilla against Mechagodzilla is one of those. This is like this is like fun, wild, cartoony kind of building destruction.
Yeah,
that came out in 2002. Maybe audiences weren't in the mood.
Maybe not.
When this one came out, and for Godzilla for that matter.
Yeah,
a lot of reliable genre entertainments kind of suffered in the wake of 9/11. Everything got really heady and serious. Slashers turned into torture movies.
Yeah,
look at what happened to Star Trek. In 2001. Star Trek Enterprise debuted the week after 9/11.
Yeah.
It was rough for Star Trek.
Yeah.
And it was all about hope and diplomacy and getting along with enemies, and nobody was in the mood.
Also, it was Enterprise. People weren't super in the mood to begin with.
Well, and also Star Trek was kind of winding down at that
Enterprise
point.
Enterprise had problems beyond the timing.
But then another 2002, Star Trek Nemesis came out. Nobody was in the mood for Star Trek Nemesis. It was the least successful
Star
Trek movie.
But that was the dark one, though.
And it was supposed to be the dark one.
Yeah.
Also,
it had the problems. It was just not good.
We didn't have something like Star Wars at that time to carry us through.
We did. Attack of the Clones came out 1 year later.
That's true. Another weird one, 2002.
Yeah.
It's a shitty movie, too.
But
I feel like there wasn't like a broad, we're going to get revenge story from genre entertainment yet. And it wasn't until like maybe the late 2000s when Hollywood kind of caught up. And then we had Avengers.
Yeah. Well, we had
avenging that kind of violence.
Well, we had
culturally.
We had in that era, like we had started in the late 90s with like some of the earlier, because Superman and Batman were always successful, but beyond that, superhero movies struggled. Blade was unexpectedly popular. X-Men proved that there's a market for these action movies, and then Spider-Man came out, and Spider-Man was the first, like, outside of Superman, like, Batman, four-quadrant superhero movie. Everyone wanted to see it. It worked as an action movie. It worked as a drama. It worked as a romance. Like, it was funny. Like, it had everything you wanted in a blockbuster movie, but what it had was a simplified morality lesson. Like, it actually had some thoughts to it, but basically it's like, oh, superheroics. Let's take all of these really complicated, difficult things and let's just make them colorful and punchy and just have larger-than-life people who live up to moral codes fighting bad guys who don't. And I think kind of that level of directness was what we were kind of hoping for and latching onto.
Oh.
And, you know, throughout the 2000s, we had more and more of it. And then Marvel Cinematic Universe kind of cracked the code in the late 2000s. But it had been building up for like a whole decade. And then it was like, oh, simplicity. This is what we're looking for. Like, there's something to be said for a guy who builds weapons, who then becomes a weapon and realizes he's done something wrong.
Mm.
And it's like, yeah, that would be great, actually. Let's go with that. That's awesome. Avengers. Oh, yeah, they're attacking New York. Wouldn't have been great if we'd had some fucking superheroes.
Yeah. It was... I firmly believe that these are all a reaction to post 9/11 trauma. That's why those kinds of movies became big right when they did.
It was, and the timing was there. Yeah.
I also feel that's why, the Star Trek 2009 movie was a big hit because it was more like Star Wars, wasn't it?
It was
like really action forward. It was about getting revenge on a bad guy. It was that simplicity again.
Yeah.
Nobody had any mood for diplomacy or like Picard's dry intellectualism.
Yeah.
And it's also worth noting that when they finally did bring Star Wars back in like 2015, the next Star Trek movie after that, the one that they tried to make like Star Wars, wasn't as big a hit.
Yeah.
We didn't need it anymore. Now we had Star Wars.
Yeah.
Star Trek was like substitute Star Wars for a second.
It wasn't until Star Trek went back on TV and started acting more like Star Trek again that people got really excited about it.
Yeah, like 3 years ago. Like, they barely caught up.
It took a while. Anyway, but that we're in the weeds. That's Godzilla against Mechagodzilla. Every other movie in the Millennium Era is a reboot, except the next one, because there actually was a proper sequel to Godzilla against Mechagodzilla, and it is Godzilla Tokyo SOS, right?
Yeah, and Mothra's back, I believe.
Godzilla. Oh, that's nice. Good for Mothra.
Well, we have Mechagodzilla back.
Yeah. Yes.
And yeah, and I think it's just Mothra.
Okay, well that's okay too. Mm. I don't mind.
Like, I don't think it's like a huge monster mash. I think it's just those three.
That's fine. Good for them.
But after that, we're going to get into Godzilla Final Wars, which sucks.
Okay.
We're going to talk a lot about Godzilla Final Wars.
You've said before, because it's been a while since you revisited a lot of these.
Yeah.
You said the next one's awesome, and then you didn't like it.
Yeah.
And then the next one sucks, and you thought it was great. We're going to keep an open mind.
I'm going to keep an open mind.
But in your memory, you don't like this one. So I haven't seen this one. In fact, we're actually running out of Godzilla movies that I haven't seen.
Okay.
Most of the other movies after we got out of the Millennium Era, except for like the anime films, I've seen them.
Yeah.
Now this will be a revisit for me, and I've actually kind of caught up a little bit. And that's kind of exciting to finally, like, you know, have all of that in my library. Yeah, that's coming up next time on Thank Godzilla It's Friday. If you want to listen to that episode early, you can head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You can listen to all of our podcasts, our new podcasts, ad-free.
Hmm.
And you get Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early. And you also get a whole bunch of exclusive shows, including our Star Trek podcast. We review every Star Trek ever, including our Oscars show. We review every movie ever nominated for Best Picture. And we have a whole libraries of like completed projects, not unlike this one, like when we reviewed every single Adam West Batman. That whole catalog is available on our Patreon. Yeah, Patreon exclusive. Or we did every episode of Firefly.
That was a fun project.
That was a hell of a project.
Watching all of the Batman episodes.
Yeah. So a huge shout out to our patrons. Thank you so much. You're awesome. We couldn't do this without you. And if you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode or anything at all, our email address, you can hear my voice going. It's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641-565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. And we're on social media at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
And until next time, Mecha Rar.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Vim, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.